For September 21st, 2018, we talk about some follow-up to that Spider-Man proposal story, Ratchet and Clank, and we ask you about your favorite times that games have honored your unexpected choices. Welcome to Level 258. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. Rocking it three style tonight here. Programming note, we're not going to have an episode next week because I will be in the process of moving. That is right. I closed on my house.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
Yay!
So,
I think I talked about that last week, right?
So yes, life level up. We talked about the potential for closing last week, but everybody knows you don't celebrate until the deal is done.
Yes.
So drove up and went to
until no takesy backsies has been called.
Yes. Until until the notary stamp has been placed on various deeds and such. Yeah. No. So the house is mine. I even went today and I ordered a washer and a dryer, which is really weird.
Oh snap!
Like I am not at the whim of my landlord for what kind of washer and dryer I have.
I gotta go look. I think we've got some LGs in our room. But the feature that I now recommend to everyone that I never knew that I wanted is that our washer and dryer sing to us when they finish their cycles.
Yeah. Somehow laying out hundreds and hundreds of dollars for these things is less insulting than the one apartment that I lived at. It was like a 4-unit and there was a single dryer, a single washer in the basement that the landlord put coin op stuff on. There were coin. Yeah. Screw him. Seriously. Going to charge me $1.50 to dry my clothes.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
we should just lay him out on the stairs.
See. Yeah. Just to like wait for him to stop by and then just hang him all over his car. Like,
yes. You know.
Yeah. No, so I don't want to be insufferable by talking about this boring thing, but
no, it's an exciting milestone of your life.
I know, yeah. So that's the way that I look at it. But man, I'm ready for this to be over. I'm ready to be settled in. Yeah, I don't like upset. I don't like change. Yeah, Dennis, how about you? How are you?
I was going to ask how many confetti guns is this equal to moving your entire stuff and buying a house?
It's a bunch, but you know the nice thing about it. So I've been in this house for I think 3 duck streams, and I am wow. Still. I've had different kinds of confetti for each ones, just because different confetti cannons go on sale. And I am still, as I, you know, go around and especially as I move furniture and box stuff up, I still find like different strata, you know, like you think that you, have vacuumed that particular corner. You know, I vacuum quite a bit. Nope. But something jostles loose and you think, oh yeah, that's so that silvery stuff. Never again. Yeah.
It's like the geology of your house.
Yep.
What you got here is a vintage 16 Spangle. He's come with silver and ruby, but most of the ruby ones have been accounted for.
Yeah, no, this is definitely a rare specimen. Yeah, no, so I'm, you know, the confetti cannons factor in. Dennis, how are you?
I'm doing good. I went to Kings Island over the weekend.
Oh, yeah?
With the kiddos. Okay. So, you know, Luke is 4 and he's easily tall enough to hit the 36 inch mark, which is required for most rides. Milo, however, I just uploaded a picture to the Slack, is probably about an inch in the picture. It was more like, you know, 3/4 of an inch wanting. So I did what any responsible parent would do. Busted out the combat boots. That gave you probably a good 1/4 inch. And then rolled up socks and put them on the heels. The remaining half. And got him that yellow wristband that got him through. So Yeah, combat boot heels are making a style comeback here, and kids on rides across the nation.
Nice. Yeah,
pretty proud of the parenting move there.
As long as you ride with him so you can grab him when he flies out of the car.
Yeah, as long as they're not like thrown clear because the safety bar doesn't hit them right.
So, you know, he wasn't so sure about face off, but
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
What are the most extreme?
For the kiddie rides.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
The face off doesn't come until next year.
Okay. Yeah. The beast, is the beast still there, or is my knowledge of King's Island 20 years out of
the
date?
Beast? No, the beast will never leave. That's like historic. Yeah. Okay, the beast is still there. The beastie, like the kiddie version of the beast, has been renamed the Woodstock Express.
Of course.
Even
yeah.
like the people manning the ride are calling it the beastie.
Okay.
Like, well, you know, the train gets back to say, how'd you guys enjoy the beastie? Woo!
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I heard they got rid of Son of Beast because it caused so many people back pain.
Yeah, that was a bad idea.
That's the inverted one, right?
Correct.
It was
The world's only inverted wooden coaster, but the inverting portion was steel, so
just kind of asterisk next to that.
But it was a great time. We rode a lot of rides, and had they have a petting zoo back there, which I mm-hmm. never remembered from my Kings Island days.
Yeah.
There's totally a petting zoo.
So I remember, you know, it's been a very long time since I've been to King's Island. I remember the kiddie stuff there being really good. However, I was more interested in like the water park portion of it. And at the time that I went, this was like in the mid 90s, King's Island's kid stuff was themed after Nickelodeon.
I remember this.
So, hey, maybe we were running around the same water park during the same summer. Who knows? And you were out there not looking for me, Dennis.
it's like, you know, you go back and watch it again and there they are. But yeah, so it's Peanuts themed now.
Yeah.
So that's good.
It's owned by Cedar Fair. Cedar Park was their kiddie stuff was Peanuts themed going way back. Also had like a weird Berenstain Bears area too, which is weird.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
I haven't thought about Berenstain Bears in forever.
I always thought it was coolest when they had the Nickelodeon themed area and you could get like slimed and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was definitely the way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have one Berenstain Bears book.
Okay.
And it's like the Berenstain Bears learn about money. And there's definitely, like, I'm not even joking, a page about how you don't bother daddy while he's doing the checkbook because he gets angry.
Oh, no.
Like, I'm not joking. I wish that was a joke.
Daddy gets real insecure about the finances. Yeah. Daddy's not sure he's that good of a provider. lean times for daddy.
Yeah. There's Big Paw Bear and Bankruptcy Bear.
Yeah. And you know, you don't want to run afoul of Bear Stearns.
Yeah.
I don't
be proud of
that
joke. It was good.
Don't reward that.
Smash cut worthy joke right there, I say.
Whew. Speaking of smash cuts, how you doing, Ben?
Is that a segue?
No, that's why I called it a smash cut.
Yeah, all right.
Because it was abrupt.
I had a nice weekend of having high expectations for Friday and being rewarded. I was really excited about season 5 of BoJack Horseman coming out, and it was great. And then there's a new album by the band Jungle that came out on Friday, and it was great. So I've been happy with both those things over the weekend. I'm already done with – I watched BoJack Horseman on Friday and finished it on Friday.
Oh, dang.
And I'm starting a second watch through of it. It's – yeah, it's really good. I think
wow,
that show – huh?
I said, wow, it's that good.
It's – I think the show, like, overall, it's just consistently good. It's not like one season stands out above the other. It's just like – it's just always good. And so I think it's moved to the number 2 show spot for me under The Wire. So,
oh, wow.
I did to BoJack what I did to Archer, which is I got to like season 3, just like eating it up. Like every second I could watch, I would watch it, and then dropping off and not being able to recapture the magic. And I'm like, it is through no fault of the show. The show did nothing wrong. It's just, it's me, not you.
I'm normally very, very capable of, you know, watching a show end to end, right, in a very short period of time. BoJack, like, it hits a little bit too many raw nerves for me, I guess. Like, I need to I need to space it out. Like, I don't know what you're doing, but how well adjusted you are that you can just watch that and be like, ah, fine. Show me more of this, please.
I usually take one or two breaks, but yeah, okay, there's it's like consistently every season. There's usually it's like its own genre of like cringe enjoyment, or I don't know. It's like something where it's just like, oh, this is terrible. Like, this is really hard to watch or whatever.
Yeah,
but then you just keep watching it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Season 4 did that a whole bunch, and season 5 there's like two or three parts like that are just like rough.
Season 4 was really rough with the dementia stuff. Like, that was
yeah.
Maybe I saw season 4. Yeah, anyway, irrelevant. Yes, it is a very good show, best enjoyed in small doses.
And the one thing I really like about the show too, and the writer talks about this guy, the creator, he talks about how like they always try and think of new ways to write an episode or interesting ways to tell a story that they haven't done before. Mm-hmm. I think there's three episodes in particular in this season where it's just really well written. One episode in particular, episode 6, is really, really good. So if nothing else, if you're not interested in watching the entire thing, you could just watch that episode by itself, and it's good. It's really, really good.
See, usually I take writers trying to think of creative new ways to tell, you know, an episode of a show as a sign that they're jumping the shark. It's like, you know, when Supernatural started doing like, well, what if we did a black and white episode? And what if we did an episode that was a musical? And
mm-hmm. Yeah.
What if, and you know, then there was like a story reason that it was that way, but it's like, clearly, no, you just wanted to make your characters sing.
Right. Yeah. That's always, if you're going to do that, it has to be laced in early, like in Community or like even BoJack does that. Like, I forget how early on they did the underwater episode.
Season 3, episode 4.
Oh, wow. Wait, chapter what? And verse.
Fish out of water. It's that is my favorite episode, or the one, episode 6 of the season is one of my favorite mm-hmm. episodes. They're both really good, and they're both conceptual episodes like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Dennis, you sounded confused.
I don't recognize that one.
Yeah, it's an episode where BoJack goes to an underwater city, like where all the fish people live, and he's in a suit and he can't hear what anybody says. So pretty much the entire episode is done without dialogue.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yep.
Yeah. But it still has a plot, and it's good. And it's like an engaging episode, even with zero lines of dialogue.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I'm happy that that lived up to your expectation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we've got the usual kind of show for you: the brief, the multiplayer, and the grind. And why don't we get started with
the brief?
The brief, where we talk about things that are happening in the world of video games around us. I'm going to open up with my story because it's a bit of follow up. I would like to thank Mai in the Slack for bringing this to my attention. So last week we named the episode after the story about the Easter egg that was included in the new Spider-Man game, where somebody basically went to Naughty Dog and said, not Naughty Dog, Insomniac, and said, hey, will you, I want to propose to my girlfriend through your game. They put the phrase, Maddie, will you marry me, onto a marquee on the theater. And I shared this story because, it's almost like a Those Damn Ross Kids story, right? Like, for as much as my intention matters, right? Like, obviously it was more, look at this doofus who did this kind of ill-advised thing, proposing to somebody basically in public, and suffered a misfortune alongside that, in that his girlfriend, left him. In the interim, right? Like, oh gosh, laughing at the dude. So this story was picked up, and not from us, but we picked it up from the other places that picked it up, and amplified. And one thing that was really missing was actually Maddie's point of view. So somebody from the Houston Press actually, reached out and talked to her to get a little bit more perspective on this, because, well,
it's a one-sided story.
Yeah. A core rule, when you're looking at, even stories with couples, is like, and at least make an effort to hear both sides. One can obviously be right and the other obviously wrong, but it's still good to know, to hear her perspective. So nothing in this that is revealed in this little write-up is especially surprising, down to the fact that, just they had been together since like the middle of high school, and their time together had kind of worn on her a little bit, and just things, you know, they were growing apart, and by the time he put in for this, they were already on the wane, especially because they were under financial strain, and he was more kind of treating her like a mom than as a partner is the way that she characterizes it. It's pretty brutal, right?
Yeah.
And so last episode when we were talking about this, I was like, oh yeah, if this is true, it's funny, if you know, but there's a high likelihood that it's made up.
Yeah, this is the internet and we can't have nice things, so there's probably a dark side.
Right. So the one part of this that was manufactured that the guy just straight up lied about, she did not leave him for his brother. That was just not the case. So kind of a weird thing to lie about in public for sympathy, you know. And the other thing that doesn't surprise me that is fucking god awful is that all of the attention that this brought negative attention to Maddie, and people have chased her off of social media because of, you know, the perceived slight that she participated in. Real ugly, gross stuff.
By not putting up with his bullshit.
Yeah. By, you know, by taking control of her life and having autonomy, she, you know, somehow deserves to be harassed off of social media. So it's a big fucking mess. I feel bad for kind of like laughing about it and not considering the other side of it, even if our position was not necessarily sympathetic to Tyler, to the proposer's point of view.
Yeah. On the contrary, I think we kind of assumed that we were feeling more bad for assuming the worst about this guy than we were for not considering Maddie's point. I think it was like the defaulting to Maddie's probably the wronged party in all of this.
Yeah, the sensible one. And if I didn't say it last episode, it's like, oh, all that you really need to know is if there is a public proposal where marriage wasn't discussed ahead of time, then fuck the person doing the proposing because they're putting them on the spot. Like, yep. No, that is a shitty stunt. Yeah.
Yeah. As the biggest advocate for marriage that you can find, marriage is not a good way to solve relationship issues.
No. And
I'm a huge fan. I'm just telling you, not going to solve anything.
Yeah. Fuck. And also even private proposals. It's my understanding. I'm not necessarily a participant in this arena. It's my understanding
from
listening to people give romantic advice on the internet. It's my understanding that even private proposals often happen after discussion of marriage. It's not just like, okay, so I discovered this thing called marriage and I'm going to take it to you and we're going to like, no, you talked about it ahead of time.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know. Any thoughts about this?
I think it should be like, you know, our perennial reminder, don't harass people online.
Yeah.
Don't make death threats to people you don't know or people you do know. Like,
yeah.
Don't do that.
Yeah, get to know them really, really well and then make the threats. Don't do that.
Yeah, there you go. Ugh.
Also, it just, you know, side note, if you're going to write an article being very sympathetic to someone being harassed online and all that, probably don't use their full name.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, I don't know, behind the scenes, she might have given explicit permission for that. That's fine. But, yeah, you know, err on the side of making them harder to find versus easier.
Right. Blah. So, oh, well, it doesn't make me want to play Spider-Man any less. So good marketing, I guess.
Here's I am so curious as to what that sign is going to be, because there's no way it just stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's got to be changed.
Maddie, take me back.
Or like, Maddie, we love you. You're doing great. You did the right thing.
I did see, again, who knows if this tweet is real. I did see a tweet that went somewhat viral of a couple who did use that as a proposal. Just kind of like, well, I'm in love with a woman, with someone named Maddie, so why don't I just swing by this, quite literally, and let's make a thing. Make use of it. Again, who knows if it's real.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's the internet, so and if last week has taught us anything, let's assume probably not.
Yep, there's no such thing as the truth.
then I think as of last week, that had been the guy's stance, was like, ah, well, someone with the name Matty used it. I'm over it. He had not been nearly as hostile as he wound up coming across.
Yeah. Blah. So anyway, Ben, what is the story that you brought?
Yeah, let's sashay out of the sad story and get to some happier news.
Yeah, let's do this.
So there was a Nintendo Direct, I think last Friday, one of the announcements in it is that they were going to port some board game video games to the Switch. So the board games that have been announced so far are Carcassonne, Pandemic, Settlers of Catan, Lord of the Rings, a card game that I'm not familiar with, and Munchkin. And this is being done by this game, or it's a publishing company called Asmodee Entertainment or something like that. And a lot of these games are already exist on Steam, like you can play them, PC versions of them then. I think there's a Scythe, which is a board game that came out recently. They have a video game of that.
So that one's complicated, right?
I mean, it's a board game. It's not crazy complicated for a board game or anything, but it's just a board game. I don't know. These are not hard things to program. Spider-Man is a hard game to program. Like, a board game is a little bit easier, but but I guess the point is a lot of these games already exist, but they're just porting them over to run on the Switch as well. So it's kind of good news for people who like board games. The thing that gets me excited about this is like a step closer to what I think the future of board gaming will be, where it's all digital. You have like a digital tabletop that you play the game on, and everybody has their own tablets that they use for their individual boards. So in that sense, I think this is cool, a cool kind of bridge towards that direction. It'll be interesting to see the implementation of this on the Switch. I'm guessing the way it'll work is each player kind of has their own camera, their own perspective of the game board, and they can kind of do their own moves, maybe, but I'm not exactly sure how these games play. I haven't played them on Steam or anything like that. I typically try and play them IRL, so
I think the Lord of the Rings card game is probably different because this game has a very specific name, but I was recently made aware of the Hobbit Tales from the Green Dragon Inn card game. And basically, like, you play the role of hobbits all around the Green Dragon Inn telling stories of their adventures. And it's like, you know, the cards are like elements of your adventure, and everyone tries to like one up each other with the stuff they've seen and all that. But I found out about it because it's like referenced in the One Ring core rulebook as something that you can like incorporate.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, I don't think it's that, but
it looks like there's a lot more. It looks like the company that's doing this, Asmodee Digital, it looks like they make, looking at their Steam page, they make a lot of board games, like Steam versions of board games.
Yeah.
So, like, I think they even have a Twilight Struggle in here, and they have Smash Up and some other games. So, probably more is to come if these are at least do well.
Yeah. My understanding is that the Twilight Struggle on Steam is actually really good.
It's not bad. That's actually one that I own. I've only played it once or twice. I think the problem is just finding other people who own it to right. play it.
Yeah.
And then there's a little bit of a learning curve of just like learning how everything works on the computer version of it versus the board game. But yeah, there are some board games that I've played that are like hot garbage. There's one of my favorite games, Terra Mystica. There was a version for it on Steam, but it was one that I think we might have talked about on the podcast, but it was one that was originally made for a phone, but they made a Steam version of it, and it is just like hot garbage. Like I could literally by myself program a better game than what they had, and like the interfaces made no sense, things like that. Like, I don't know. But it was programmed for mobile and just ported over for PC. So that's probably why. So
nice.
Whatever. Yeah. Anyway, so this is cool for people who like board games.
Mm-hmm. There was a bunch of cool stuff at that Nintendo Direct that I think merits, some discussion. For me, the biggest thing is the presence of Final Fantasy on the Switch. Okay. They're going to be bringing FF12, the Zodiac Age, and then also Final Fantasy 7, 9, and 10. Fuck you, Final Fantasy 8. Nobody likes you. That's not right. It's just very weird when you run from 7 to 10 and then conspicuously leave out 8. That doesn't make a lick of sense to me, but I wonder if
that makes sense according to Nintendo distribution logic.
Yeah, maybe, but I wonder if, like, so there's no iPad or iOS version of Final Fantasy VIII either, so I wonder if that's the case, like the version that we get is using the iOS one as a bridge. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
yeah That's a big thing for me is the presence of that, along with, like, weirdly, Luigi's Mansion is a hot commodity right now. And they're still making stuff for the Nintendo 3DS, even though they explicitly said they weren't. So, yeah. Any other stuff about that?
That's all I got.
Okay. And Dennis, round us out. What's going on in the world of Horizon?
Yeah, enough of these board games going to video games. I want to talk about a video game.
Going the other way, thanks.
Yeah. So there's a Kickstarter that was massively successful already for a Horizon Zero Dawn board game.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't gotten to watch all the materials associated with it, but it is a kind of cooperative 1-4 player game all about hunting down giant robots as a primitive, you know, either tribe person or, you know, any one of the clans from Horizon Zero Dawn. And all the specific names are escaping me now. Osaram, Karja, there's a couple others. Anyway, so it looks really cool, and the boxes for it are gigantic. So this was a game clearly designed by someone who loves miniatures for people who love miniatures. And I want to say, where's the number? There's something like 120 miniatures in the game if you buy all the extras.
Good God.
Yeah, so it is absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
But it follows the really interesting trend that started with, I believe, Gloomhaven, although, Ben, you can tell me if you know of a game that did it earlier, where, you know, all the enemies are kind of AI controlled, a la a card deck.
Mm-hmm. I think Gloomhaven is one of the first bigger ones to do that. Like, there's some games that have, there's this company called Autonomy Factory that will make one player versions of games. And so they'll make, like, basically AIs for the other parts of the game. So one of the first games to do that was Scythe from a couple of years ago. And then some other games mm-hmm. like Gaia Project have it now. But yeah, I think you're over, by and large, you're right that Gloomhaven is one of the first ones where that was built into the main game. So
yeah,
popularized it.
The Dark Souls board game does that as well. Yeah,
exactly.
Yes, there you go. Yep. And I believe this is by the same company that does that. So
no, I don't Steam believe so.
Forge games.
Steamforge. Yes. Sorry.
Yes. There we go. So yeah, kind of similar concept where, you know, 1-4 people working together take down a robot.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be some kind of permanence in terms of, like, building your hunter's deck. So there's, you know, a lot of card based play here. But this kind of has the very diegetic reason for having these AIs in that it is literal robots
mm-hmm.
that you're fighting, which is a cool idea. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, the miniatures are the big story here, especially for the larger robots. They are very big and very detailed. And I'm, you know, I have my finger perpetually twitching above the buy button for this, or the back button for this, yeah. I guess I should say. But either way, I'm very excited to see the painted miniatures that come out of this. It'll be very cool.
Yeah, man.
But it almost makes me wonder if these Kickstarter campaigns are getting too ambitious, because this is a Kickstarted project that is going to start with 3 expansions
mm-hmm.
and will probably come out about the same time that Horizon Zero Dawn 2 comes out. Not that there's been one announced. It's just that's about when it would come out.
The projected ship date is March of 2020.
Right.
So they're giving themselves plenty of time. I would be more concerned about that if it was apparent that the expansions were all stretch goals.
Mm-hmm.
That is usually where campaigns like this get in trouble, right?
Well, yeah, these are baked in, and then the base pledge amount is $95 to get any rewards.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
Absolutely crazy. Or excuse me, £95. So.
So about probably $180, something like that.
$123. We're doing all right.
Yeah. I always just double, double pounds to dollars. I don't know when I got that assumption, but.
Yeah. From a worse economic time, apparently.
Yeah.
I just want to jump in with a possible controversial statement, but I feel like video game board games are kind of like video game movies, where I haven't seen ones that have impressed me too much. And a lot of times I feel like they're just trying to get money from the people who are really into the original material, like the video game.
Yeah.
Now, come on, you played XCOM with me.
Oh, shit. That's right. XCOM is really good.
Yeah, that's a thing.
That might be the one. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean,
it's the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah, because it's, I mean, the Dark Souls board game looks cool or whatever, but I haven't really seen people like
it's not really that fun. Like when I've played it, I mean, admittedly, I've only ever played it by myself. When I've played it by myself, I have had to make modifications to the rules to make it tolerable.
Yeah. So yeah,
what about Bloodborne? Bloodborne had one that very much followed the kind of zeitgeist of the Horizon Zero Dawn game.
Yeah, so Bloodborne had a card game, but it was kind of a very strange design in that it was all about the chalice dungeons, leaning into kind of the randomness of it. Mm-hmm. And also it was kind of a co-op competitive game where you were working together until you weren't. And it, mm-hmm. it wasn't necessarily balanced for both of those modes to feel fun. That is per Gary, who is the person who I know who has played that with his game group.
Gotcha.
Got it.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not trying to dissuade you. It's just, it's like, so far I'm waiting to be impressed, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. The Dark Souls board game, you know, kind of gave me a once bitten, twice shy kind of thing.
Yeah. And you'll have to wait until 2020 to be impressed.
Yeah. And I will say you are right. The XCOM game is really good.
Yes.
It also is the game that probably like differs most significantly from the actual activities you're doing in the video game.
They made a lot of very, very good choices with separating the roles and kind of having not like different rhythms of play because everybody's pinned the same clock, but you know, disparate things to do that all fed to each other. That is like incredibly finely tuned.
Yeah, they translated the stress of the game and like the theme of the game, but not necessarily the mechanics.
Like if XCOM was just a miniatures combat game where you were like, you know, okay, I'm going to move five spaces this way and have an attack range of so and so, I could not see it being as good.
And the temptation to do that had to be so high because it's such an obvious transferal, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So kudos to them on that one.
Yeah.
Nice. Man, these robot designs are neat.
Oh yes. Has anyone else played Horizon Zero Dawn here?
No, I want to.
I played the game for, I don't know, I put maybe 10 or 15 hours in it and just kind of bounced off it eventually. A slow bounce, but
okay. Yeah. It's good. It is worth getting your hands on at some point.
Yeah. I think what turned me off is I think I got into a part of the game where I couldn't like win and I hadn't saved anything before that, or like it was a long time before my last autosave. So it's just like, oh, I guess I'm done.
That sucks.
Yeah.
Oh. I think this section's over.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer where we ask you a question and then you answer it. Dennis, what did you ask the nice people?
Yeah, so I asked, in the world of video game story choices, zigging when the developer clearly wants you to zag usually leads to mediocre results, but that's not always the case. So we want to know, when was the time that a game has surprised you with how well fleshed out its less traveled story paths are? This is based on just the truism that, you know, oftentimes when developers are writing story choices, there's like the right one, and then there's throwaway choices to make it look like you have choice. Mm-hmm. But every now and again, you get surprised, and they've actually thought through the less than probable choices that they offer up to you.
Yeah, you're not as railroaded as you think. Mm-hmm. So I will lead off here with Paul, who says, The Witcher 3. I've got no specific examples, but remember enjoying some of the random side stories and Witcher contracts as much or more than the main quest. Absolutely. I think The Witcher 3 specifically trades on dealing with incomplete information. And so you will run into these situations where the choice is not necessarily obvious enough of the time that when something seems like the choice is obvious, they will have considered the other way that it could have gone.
Yes. From what I understand, The Witcher 3 is essentially side quest of the game.
Yeah. The main quests are very good, though.
Yeah. It's just that their side quest bar is really high.
Yes.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And the main quest stuff feels like side quest material a lot of the time, like so much so that quote unquote main quests are actually kind of containers for smaller quests that are about the size of side quests that all kind of will push you forward to a common goal.
I think one example I can remember, there's like a side quest where you like fight a dragon in The Witcher 3, and it's just like this really detailed thing that they probably had to program of like the dragon flying around and chasing it and attacking it. It's like the only time you see that specific one in the game.
Yeah.
And it's side quest. It's just a random side quest. Yeah.
I think that, yeah, no, that was the one where you had to chase a sheep to that tower to use as bait or something.
I'm not sure about that. I can't remember that.
Ben, what does Jeremy say?
Jeremy says, Bloodborne for sure. All the areas that you don't need to explore to finish the game, like Hemwick Charnel Lane or Chainhurst, yet all the lore items that you get to experience are totally worth the time spent veering left and going off the beaten path. Yeah.
Yep.
I totally missed Chainhurst on my playthrough.
Oh, no. Have you?
I know.
I mean, did you fix that? Did you go and play?
No, I haven't gone back to it yet. I should. I just haven't.
Have you? I forget. Did you do the old Hunters?
I did not. I haven't done any of the DLCs. I haven't done Kanehurst.
Okay.
I got Charnel Lane.
Yeah. Obviously, it's a long game, and no, you know, it would be thoughtless of me to say you need to play that thing next. Kanehurst is very good. The old Hunters is very good. The next time you find yourself hungering for Soulsborne, like that is some. Let's see here, Chef Fingers content.
Yeah, I've eventually wrapped around again to Demon's Souls. I eventually wrapped around again to Dark Souls 2. So you know, it's very possible I'll be going back through Bloodborne at some point.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Let's see, Dennis, what does Greg say?
He says, a lot of modern games do this very well, but the game that first made a huge impression on me with its less traveled paths, very well developed, was Fallout. No matter what choice you made, it was developed. However, the oldest game I recall playing that did this was Wing Commander from 1990, which has fleshed out story paths and cutscenes even for the losing path. It's a shame the franchise is mostly forgotten today. Spent so much time playing those games in my youth. Man, Wing Commander from way back.
Yeah. Man, we need to do one of those games on WoW eventually, like a game of that ilk.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Wing Commander's a good answer. I don't know that I have anything else to add on top of that. So I will take this and say, Lindsay says, Super Mario World with the Star World and the special levels.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. No, that's those special levels, not just the Star Road, like weird little colored Yoshi challenges ones, but like, yeah, well, why don't we just put these like ROM hack hard levels in here and call them things like awesome and radical. And just say, haha, you think you're good at this game, huh? Well, okay, deal with this. Good stuff. Ben, what does Juan say?
Juan says, I have to agree on Fallout. Some of my favorite pastimes in the series are finding the vaults and discovering the experiments through set pieces and terminal entries. Also, those Daedric quest lines in Skyrim, always worth completing. Yeah, I think those are two good answers.
Yeah. Yep. I think a common theme that's coming out is not so much, you know, like taking what seems like an illogical path and seeing something, but more developers having the confidence to put, let's say, incredibly calorie dense content in places where people might not actually seek them out or find them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dennis, what does David say?
David says, Fallout 4 Nuka World DLC. There's always been content in games like this that allow for evil options, but the meat of this DLC is only accessible for less moral characters. Interesting. It's basically just a shooting gallery for the good guys. Fun to see some evil-focused content, as usually it's split pretty equal or more, good leading. And yeah, I think that is the primary way that that games kind of fail on this front.
Mm-hmm.
Is they have a, you know, something that is a good and evil or less good option, and just the less good or evil option is not satisfactory.
Yeah, usually makes you feel bad instead of you like relishing in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Franz writes, since Fallout was already mentioned, I'll pick Deus Ex. With some knowledge of the systems, you could bend the story pretty far without it actually breaking. The original System Shock also did this very well. Since that game was almost entirely simulated and system-driven, you could sequence break a lot without getting the story going haywire.
Hmm.
Yeah. Sequence breaking, man. Especially Well, there's a fantastic thing in Deus Ex, like where it's nearly impossible to save your brother, but if you do, he's like, wow, I'm really surprised that you did that. Like, yeah. Like that was that's not how this should have gone, but okay, here we go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh man.
Now there's an idea that we'll get to that. I was gonna say a great idea for a game that is a little bit Stanley Parable-esque.
Mm-hmm.
Of like, you know, having some objective that is incredibly difficult to reach, and you know, would require multiple save attempts, and then just have that start creating like paradoxes in reality and mess everything up in a really interesting way.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of Stanley Parable,
that's right.
Ben, what does Christopher say?
Christopher says, I think the Stanley Parable is a perfect example of this. Nothing like destroying a narrator's good time.
Or David's good time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good somewhere. Episode for him to not be on.
Somewhere. He's like, why is this vein throbbing in my forehead? That's really yeah. weird.
Something, something. Stanley Parable is great at destroying good times. Something, something.
Yeah, if somebody didn't mention Stanley Parable, I absolutely would have. So
sure.
Yeah.
Dennis, what does Jonathan say?
He says, time for the obligatory Dark Souls reference.
Yeah.
When I started the game, I went to the catacombs from the Firelink Shrine bonfire, as we all did, as it was the location that I felt the game was signaling me to go to. Upon my encounter with the skeletons, I had my confidence shattered. As I threw myself at the counter, I slowly began to learn the intricacies of the combat system. When I finally found the route to Undead Burg, I was proficient at parrying and managing space, as well as timing my attacks so as to not deplete the stamina bar. TLDR, Dark Souls is good because if you stray off the course, you'll probably learn something new.
Yeah, your skill set was probably like 4 or 5 areas ahead by that point. So
it's the wrong direction, but not wasted time.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Yeah. Mike says, I've been playing through Metal Gear Solid 5 off and on over the past few weeks, and it never fails to astound me just how varied and robust its systems are, no matter how you choose to approach a mission. It's not just that it's possible to complete a mission by total stealth, by Rambo-style destruction, or by somewhere in between, but that when you do it, it feels like the way it was intended all along. I can be love-hate with some of the choices Hideo Kojima makes in his games. Put a goddamn shirt on, quiet. but his attention to detail is second to none. Chris. Yeah. Like, when Kojima is willing to put control of the game into your hands, it creates kind of a chain reaction where, regardless of how many small failures you had on the way to success, it creates a feeling of, oh, I meant to do that. Like, it still feels great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very good. Ben, what does Jack say?
Jack says, I was genuinely surprised by how deep some of the side stories were in Morrowind. For a place that you were supposed to feel like an unwanted outsider, there sure are a lot of people who will talk to you and give you quests.
Yeah. Morrowind in particular. So if we're going to look at these choices as things you can do around like sequence breaking and things, you can kill basically God in that game. You can kill anybody who is on your main quest line, and there is still a way around to get to the end. It is nearly impossible to make that game unwinnable. It's possible to make that game incredibly difficult for yourself. But like, you know, if you decide like, well, I'm not going to suffer this demigod to live, then well, here you go, do it, and then just live with that consequence if you still want to save the world. Yeah,
that's incredible. I mean, the branching, like, someone's done the diagram of that game's branching paths.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be very interested to see how many sheets of paper that takes up.
Let's see here. Dennis, what does Sam say?
He says, when the director's cut version finally came out on PS3, I did all of the side quests on Deadly Premonition and didn't regret it. Not only did Swery and his team make a delightful, fleshed-out stories for basically every single NPC in the game, they also hid game mechanics such as fast travel behind optional side quests. From what I've read online, you can even follow NPCs and look in their windows and figure out plot points in the game long before they come up in the main story. That's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Say what you want about Deadly Premonition being janky garbage, but it puts more or less every open-world game to shame. And don't get me started on the conversations that happen when you spend time driving around between missions.
Yeah. That window peeking thing is a way to figure out who the killer is.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah. Like if you know where to look and when, and you can notice kind of a pattern for them, they're like, oh wait, shit, really? Yeah. Yeah, Deadly Premonition.
Now, does the game allow you to then like quickly advance to the finale from there, or is it like, all right, you figured it out, but you still have to go through all the machinations of the main plot?
The latter.
Well, okay, gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Hence the jankiness, I guess.
Yeah. Take that, Deadly Premonition.
Take that praise, Deadly Premonition. Oh, man. Let's see. That was you reading that, Dennis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was. So Alexander says, a bit of a cheat, but certain modern text adventure games do this astonishingly well. They kind of have to. This is the game. The best one I've played is Choice of Robots, which not only allows you to design your own prototype robot, but very tiny decisions you make in its construction can spiral out to futures as varied as you creating an artificial race capable of sentience and even love, to becoming the turning point in a future war with China that devastates the Pacific, to essentially pulling a Dr. Wily and becoming the overlord of the Earth via your death machine children. Good futures, apocalyptic futures, and all the shades of gray in between. It's a very good ride. That game sounds great. Choice of Robots.
That mm-hmm. seems like it would be a good stream game, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need to look that up because that sounds very neat. Yeah, Ben, what does Allison say?
Allison says, in Far Cry 4, at the very beginning, you're captured by the big bad. At a certain point, he gets called away, leaving you alone, and you're supposed to use this time to escape. If you wait around for a while, he comes back, and you play a short sequence, and the game rolls credits. Yep.
That is so good. I didn't believe that when somebody described that on a podcast, and I watched a video and I'm like, well, shit. And then finally, Dennis, what does Nathan say?
He says, Dark Souls 3. I stumbled on the Dancer early. Must have spent 1 week in real life busting my ass on it, and had one of my more euphoric Souls experiences upon its defeat. Kicked myself upon learning that I did these things in the wrong order, but was certainly rewarded for zigging. Dark Souls 1 also bears mentioning for the catacombs.
Yeah, see, the disappointing thing about beating the Dancer, especially when you're not aware you're not supposed to be fighting her, is that behind her is Lothric Castle, which is far more outleveled for you.
isn't the Dancer a two-parter? Like, don't you go straight from that into another boss fight, or am I misremembering?
I think you might be misremembering. I could also be misremembering as well.
Okay. I want to say there is some boss fight that you like, you know, you finally scrape through and beat it, and then it just drops you straight into another boss fight.
That definitely happens at the end of Dark Souls 2.
Mm.
Yeah. Where you fight the Throne Watcher and Throne Defender, and then...
Yes. And then go straight in. Yep. Yeah. I remember that. No, I think... I wonder if you put off fighting the Dancer for long enough, that there's something that drops you there. Yeah, I'll look it up.
Yeah. So my answer is going to be Alpha Protocol, because it is a game that is entirely made of this. To the point where you can intentionally try to screw things up in ways that it is surprising the game even provides to you. You know, such as like, I don't know, goading this extremely prim and proper and professional guy with just sarcastic comments. You think, okay, well, this is not going to work to my advantage. No, turns out that is exactly what you need to get him to make a bad decision. Oh, and there you go. You have found another way around by making the illogical decision. and the way that everything is interleaved in Alpha Protocol means that the game just runs on that concept from front to back.
Mm-hmm.
Alpha Protocol is an amazing video game.
Now, is it such that there still are fail conditions, or is it just like everything is eventually a win condition?
You can lock yourself out of stuff.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And everything kind of feeds into the end. I don't think there's anything that makes the game unwinnable. But
except for that fight with the German or the Russian guy. Like,
I think even if you don't do the drug poisoning thing, I think he's still defeatable.
It's just a really hard part of the game.
Yeah, it's like it ends up being like a real wall for people, as opposed to, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Ben, how about you?
I think my answer for this is Metal Gear Solid Snake Eater. And that's like, it's not like necessarily like straight path, like, or like main path, like side path. It's just, there's so many things where it's like, oh, I see the bad guy right now. I could probably shoot him. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh yeah, you can, and it'll kill him. Like, go for it. You know, like, we've thought about that. And there's just so many things like that in the game that, yeah, it's just a real joyous experience if you do any of those things.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to the previous discussion of Kojima candy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, so I guess I would say either Skyrim and mm-hmm. the Elder Scrolls games in general just thrive on, you know, wandering off, finding random things, but also just making weird story choices and have it pan out. Mm-hmm. But the other game that came to mind, and I haven't played enough of it to speak with authority, but it's Hitman.
Hmm.
Yeah. It just feels like any conceivable way that you could go with taking someone out, they've thought about and given you options for.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like one difference with that is like there's always like only a single path of like 100% stealth, like get your suit back sort of thing or whatever that you, but yeah, there are a lot of fun aside ways to kill people.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah. And this is just a random tangent, but the one thing that I'm craving in all the like assassination type of games, like there's a lot of good, like, you know, being able to plan out and execute different ways of going, or you can kind of brute force and muddle your way through it. But I don't know if there's one yet that really makes you feel like you're improvising in a skilled way, if that makes any sense. Like makes it feel like, oh, things went to shit, but I still, like things went to shit and I brute forced it is different than things went to shit and I found a different cool way to achieve what I wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like one of the barriers of that is like once you get discovered or whatever, that's like a one way direction thing where it's like, you can't undo that. And so it doesn't really provide a lot of recovery system, I guess, but outside of just restarting the mission. So
yeah, I mean, but the later games are especially are designed around that.
Yeah.
You know, knowing that you'll restart or knowing you want to experiment with different ways, they keep that in mind.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you everybody for responding. If you want to participate in these, go to facebook.com/thelevelpodcast and watch for the prompts to go up on Monday afternoons. Not next Monday though. We're not going to be here next Monday. Monday after that though. Yeah.
You betcha.
The grind.
Now it is time for the grind where we talk about the things we have been playing over the past period of time or so. Ben, I feel like I never ask you to go first, so I'm going to ask you to go first.
Yay. I don't have too much to talk about. I finished Spider-Man, so I beat that, I think, a day or two after I talked about it last week. Main quest holds up. It's good, like, pretty much all the way to the end. Afterwards, I tried doing some of the side quests. It's kind of, again, like, the structure of the game is very similar to, like, Arkham City or Arkham Knight. There's, like, quote-unquote, like main side quests, I guess, like, scattered around the city, and then there's a bunch of stuff to do that are, like... So I did all the, like, the cinematic, like, side quests or whatever that they had. I was a little bit disappointed by them. Like, some of them were okay, but they weren't really, there wasn't really a lot of, I guess, production behind them or anything. It was a lot of, like, hey, go here, do this, or whatever. And there weren't really, like, many interesting, like, characters introduced by them. It could be that I'm just not as familiar with the Spider-Man franchise as opposed to, like, Batman. So, like, the people that they did introduce, like, didn't seem that impactful to me, whereas they might have been cooler to somebody who's like Spider-Man fanboy.
One fan's shit moment is another fan's meh.
Yeah. And I could totally see that being the case, I guess. So overall, I think it's like, yeah, play the game for the main quest, and you don't have to go back to it if you don't want to. You can do all, you can try and 100% the game, and I think what you get out of that is you get different suits that are unlocked for Spider-Man. But I don't know. I think I'm like at a pretty fine done point with it. So I definitely think it's a game that you could probably like rent if that still exists and like play the main quest in like a couple days and like knock it out and then be happy with it.
Redbox is this.
Yeah, I'm not trying to devalue it or anything. It is like a solid main quest game. I would put it maybe close to like what a Batman game's main quest would be. I still hold this in really special favor, but it's definitely close to that.
Mm-hmm. How deep do they dig for the big bad? Like who's the main villain behind all of it? And is it anyone that would be recognizable to a casual fan?
Yeah, they have, I think, 6 or 7 main bad guys in the main quest line. I think there were maybe only one or two that I, didn't like explicitly remember from like watching the cartoons. So it's mostly people that you know, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's and those are I think those are well done and everything. Yeah, I would say it's better than Uncharted 3, not as good as Uncharted 2, somewhere in that territory.
I didn't know they made an Uncharted 3.
Yeah, it's weird. You know, it was like a Leisure Suit Larry thing. They skipped one of them as a joke. even with your hedging and saying, hey, maybe make it a rental, you're still doing a very good job of making me want to play this game.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the core mechanics, like, not bad. Swinging around is pretty fun. The fighting system's, like, pretty solid. It is a solid game. For example, I wouldn't put it above God of War. I still think that's the best game in 2018 so far. Mm-hmm. But I can't think of anything that would be second outside of Spider-Man, so.
Nice.
By the way, we were joking about Spider-Man killing people by throwing them off of roofs and had goofed that, like, oh, they'll just grab a spare piece of webbing that's around.
Yeah.
And I wrote in a contributor extraordinaire on this episode and all the time. And she said that literally if you throw someone off a roof, you will find them later dangling from some webbing that was on the side.
Good.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, because there was one mission where there's some mechanic where it's like innocent people are attacking other people sort of thing, whatever. I won't describe what it is or whatever. But there's like one mechanic where we were put in a situation where you're like beating up civilians or whatever. And it's like, I was definitely kicking them off for like roofs and stuff. And it's like, I don't think this is really great. I don't think Spider-Man should be doing this, but whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spider-Man superfan, let me know if this exists. Not like I'll go and read it or anything, but is there kind of a side story, or is it ever accounted for, like what a window washer in Peter Parker's Manhattan goes through on a daily basis?
I think they ignore that part. Yeah, nor like you never see like webs that you've already shot or anything like that. So they just kind of do the clean take of it, where they just pretend
it's
that
highly biodegradable.
I think that's the idea.
I'm just figured it out.
A few minutes.
Yeah, I mean, like spider webs ought to be biodegradable too. I mean, they come out of a carbon thing, so it should be fine. But those stick around forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. He
some spiders do. He eats it back up after he's done for the day to make sure he's replenished for next time.
Reclaims those nutrients. However, I think this version of Spider-Man is he's got the web shooters as opposed to being organic webs like Sam Raimi's one is.
Yeah. His things that look like Fitbits that he puts on his wrist to shoot out webs.
Yep.
Which is the more fantastic part of that? The wall climbing superpowers or the infinite tensile strength web shooters that never run out? Like, just give him the webs in his arms, man. Yeah. Like,
I think in both versions though, like he runs out of webbing just when the plot demands that he needs to.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a plot shortage.
That is a plot device that never comes up, as he never runs out of webbing like halfway through swinging or something like that, and you have to go find more or something like yeah. that. So, well, I mean, no. I guess, yeah.
In the,
I guess
the PlayStation games, like the OG PlayStation games, that was a serious concern. You had to, like, go find refills.
Yeah.
I don't think it happened in Spider-Man 2. I think you had infinite webbing in that one. But,
you absolutely did, yeah.
No, the OG PlayStation
games. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that's Spider-Man. What else have you been playing?
I think that's mostly it. I already talked about Black the Fall last week. I haven't played any other PC games out of that. I mean, of course, I've always been playing Magic and streaming that, and I've been playing Rocket League and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I've been pretty happy. I streamed over the weekend some drafting, and I've had over 10 viewers watch them on my stream, so that's a new milestone.
Nice.
I know. So I've been happy about that. That's kind
were
of fun.
Were they talkative?
Yeah, some of them were. It's like, you know, like probably half of them were talking to various times. So
nice.
One person.
What is your time bank in the Magic game? Like,
what do you mean?
So in Hearthstone, you have like 90 seconds to complete your turn, or else it ends it for you.
Gotcha, yeah. There's like a timer and it's based on responding to like prompts. So like unlike in Hearthstone Magic, there's like a lot of back and forth, like, okay, this person just did this. Are you gonna respond with anything? Okay, cool. And like it'll automatically pass things if you're like tapped out of mana and you can't do anything. But if you do have an option of like something you can respond to a situation, it'll give you like maybe like 20 or 30 seconds, but then you have timeouts, which are like you have like three of them. And so like if you don't do anything in 20 or 30 seconds, it'll burn a timeout. And if you run out of all your timeouts and then you run out, then you like automatically concede.
Got it.
So the idea is like it shouldn't take you too long to like click on these sorts of things. So like I think it's a pretty happy balance because I know on Magic Online what they do is they just give both players 25 minutes, and when somebody's out of time they lose. But it leads to bad situations where somebody disconnects or if they just like leave or something, you're just sitting there waiting, you know, and they could be back in like 15 minutes or they're not, you know. So it puts you in a bad situation. Whereas in Arena, the way it works is like you know that after a minute, like you're just gonna win if they don't do anything. So you have, you know, you don't have to sit around and twiddle your thumbs as long. So that
Yeah,
part's
that's a
nice.
little more elegant. The reason I was asking is that in my days of streaming Hearthstone, and I would try to like, you know, take advice from people watching and like, you know, discuss moves with them, but that's incredibly stressful if your stream has a little bit of lag.
Oh,
Because you know your rope is winding down and the person's like, "I see it. I see the perfect turn. You have lethal. First you this, then you that." Then, you know, all the while the rope is burning down, you're like, okay, I got it. Phew.
There's it's also nice with Arena when you do drafting, you're drafting against robots, so you're not drafting against people, so you have infinite time on that, which is really helpful because
Oh,
like you can
smart.
just sit and wait and you can like say like, yeah, here's what I'm thinking, I think these cards are good picks, I think these are okay picks or whatever, and you can wait after like 30 seconds or a minute, you can hear what the response is from people who are watching, and then you can kind of talk it out. So that I
You
have
can
been.
literally sleep on it if you want.
Yeah, you could if you wanted to, yeah. But yeah, that's something that Magic Online is a little bit different, where it's like you have 45 seconds to make a pick. So if you have lag, then you might, you know, be harder to get response from chat. So yeah. Yep.
Nice.
What's your streaming handle, buddy?
It's Merkleby on Twitch. I always say that, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
You've seen some of my stuff. You know my stuff. I guess you're just
No,
helping me.
it's just
Yeah.
this is an apropos moment to mention it.
Yeah.
Thanks, man. Yeah.
Cool. Well, Dennis, how about you? What have you been playing?
Yeah, I've been playing more Ratchet and Clank, and that's continued to be fun. I've encountered more levels that are definitely like new to the game. So that's been fun. In general, they've been high quality, and they've been like spectacular boss battles and stuff like that. I've started reaching the level cap for some of my weapons, which presents that eternal problem of like when you reach the level cap, the weapon undergoes some really cool transformation. So like the what is it, the plasma drum, which is like this, you know, this stationary totem that you fire into the ground, and then it does wave damage to everything around it. Well, it gets upgraded so that now there's also an electrical bolt that latches onto the biggest nearby enemy. And so it's like really cool to see these new functions that your weapons all of a sudden have. But now every second spent using that weapon is a second spent not leveling one of your other weapons that has not reached the level cap. So now I'm doing the dance of maxing out the level, getting a really cool transformation, and immediately ceasing to use it whatsoever.
That's like another issue in like Resident Evil 4, where like you upgrade the weapon to its max ability and something cool unlocks, but they mitigate that by having like the ammo system where it's like, oh, well, I'm out of ammo for this, so I have to use something else now.
Yeah. But you know, that's fine because there's still lots of other cool mechanics in all the weapons. I just got the Sheepinator, which I don't think was in the first game originally. I think it was in the second game. But the idea of turning your enemies into sheep is never going to be not fun. And then if you turn a sheep, so if you train the Sheepinator on a current sheep, it will eventually explode in a, I think they call it a paradox explosion.
Oh no. So
Because you're
you don't
sheepinating.
just kill them, you annihilate them.
Yes, you sheepinate a sheep, and create a thing that should not be, I guess.
Yeah, I that's one way to go. I was gonna guess it turns it into a sweater.
Oh, that'd be good. Or turn it back into the enemy. Oops, shouldn't have done that.
Yep.
But yeah, so it's just fun and creative weapon ideas. And these are all things that have been in other games, but I didn't really play games after the first two or so Ratchet and Clanks. So I'm getting a lot of mileage out of it.
Nice.
Yeah. So that one's fun. I picked up an iPhone game. I was looking for just a little distractor, Desert Golf was not feeling like the right thing at the moment. So I picked up a game called Impossible Road.
Hmm.
And this is kind of your downhill racer kind of game, but it's really smoothly done, and the physics for it seem pretty good. But you're rolling a marble down a very thin track that is just careening downhill at all times, and it kind of ribbons around and spirals and turns and zigzags back and forth as you go, generated procedurally.
Right.
And so you try to cross as many gates on this track as you can before falling off. But the really interesting thing about this game is falling off is not the end, because that ribbon goes down, down, down. And as long as you orient yourself correctly, you can hit the track at a lower point and get back on.
Mm-hmm.
But to the whole physics thing, you will definitely bounce off when you impact.
So you need to find it so it's curving along with your existing trajectory.
Exactly. You kind of have to calculate the angle you're going into it or where on the track you're hitting it. So that you don't just get flung off in a random direction.
Yeah, it's like multi-dimensional Excitebike.
Yeah, yeah. It counts your score by the gates that you pass, and in roughly like every story or so of falling, mm-hmm. Probably more than that, given the rate you're going downwards. But every so often you'll cross a gate, but you only get points for that gate if you literally hit the gate.
Yeah, if you're in contact with the road. So if you fly off, you're missing point opportunities.
Exactly. Now you make it up. Like once you cross, like let's say you fall from gate 32 to 36, your score will jump up to 36. You won't have missed a beat. But it creates these like frantic, crazy moments where you've flown off the track, you managed to hit it again, but now you're just bouncing off, falling a long time, bouncing off, falling a long time, bouncing. And you're like, I need to find a gate. I've gotten so many points. I need to find a gate before I lose this run. I just let me cross one gate. And it adds this great intensity to the end of the game. If you fall for too long without touching the road, or the track, your screen will start to fade to white. And if it gets all the way there, you lose. And that also creates some really interesting things where it's almost like blacking out as you fall. And then you finally hit the track at the last second and everything pops back into color.
And we're back.
It's like Subnautica. Yeah.
And it is color, singular. It's blue. The track is blue, and that's really the only color in the game.
Yeah.
Very, very cool, minimalist style to it.
Are you controlling it with your accelerometer, or are you controlling it by touching and dragging?
No, that would be horrible. You control by tapping either the left or the right side of the screen.
Okay.
Turn left or right. Which is good. I'm slightly annoyed. You have to play the game, holding the phone sideways, which, the number of times, if I could just play it vertical and drag my thumb back and forth to steer, I would much prefer that.
Yeah.
The number of times you are one-handed when you want a time waster, the percentage of times is pretty high.
Yeah.
So it's a little annoying that it's a game that demands a bit more attention than I want to give to it. But then again, I'm playing on a 5S, so me holding my phone sideways is essentially the base width for most iPhones now.
Yes.
I suppose I'm going to have to get used to that.
Yeah, if you want to go forward. Man, I miss the 5S.
God, yeah, it's a good little phone. It's slowing down though, so I think I'm going to replace it. But...
No, that XR actually looks pretty neat to me, or 10R or whatever the fuck they're calling it. But
yeah,
I wish that there was still something in that. Just like that solid block of aluminum and glass. Give me that.
Yes. Yeah. So Impossible Road is actually behind a paywall. That's the wrong way to say it.
It is not free.
It's not free. It costs $3 like a normal fucking game. So like $3 is a great price to play for a game like this.
I'm watching there's a version of this on Steam called Super Impossible Road or something like that. It is not as sparse in its graphical presentation, and I wonder if that is contributing to or detracting from the sense that I'm getting that it would make me incredibly motion sick.
It's a good question. Yeah, I'm looking at images of it now, and it seems very busy compared to what I play. There's something very zen, especially when you're falling and you've kind of spotted the point you want to land, but you've got a good 3 or 4 seconds before you hit it.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's, it is a very frantic game overall, but that moment is very, you know, very serene.
Yeah.
In a cool way.
Nice.
And I definitely appreciate like the simplicity of it overall.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, super, not super Impossible Road, Impossible Road.
Impossible Road.
Yeah, I've been playing. So those are the video games I've been playing. I have also tried a new board game since we last spoke. And ooh. Ben, I think it's one that you gave to Emma, my little sister, your cousin.
Mm-hmm.
Splendor is the name of the game.
Yeah. Yeah. That game's cool.
It is a resource management game where you are, buying and managing diamonds and gems and mines for those, mm-hmm. Trying to earn a level of respectability throughout the course of the game. And it's a lot of fun. Like you can collect loose gems, which you have to like cash in if you want to buy a mine. But then the mine has like a permanent gem. So it counts towards your total, but you don't spend it when you use it to buy something. Like it's always there. So you can collect diamonds and emeralds until you have enough to buy a ruby mine. And then you always have a ruby, which you can use to buy other kinds of mines and all that. The mines vary in their expensiveness, their level of cost, from like the cheap ones that don't really have many side benefits to more expensive ones that actually have the like respect points that you're trying to earn. And then there are patrons as well that once you reach a certain threshold of mines, so call it like if you have 4 emerald mines and 4 diamond mines, then a patron will come and visit you if you're the first one to hit that mark, and they have an amount of respect points associated with them. So it's really...
And respect points here are like victory points, so whoever gets the 15 victory points first wins.
Yeah. And what's funny is when you start that, like the ramp up on this game is really interesting, because when you start out, like 15 points just seems forever away. And then you're like, oh, well, I've got about like 5, maybe I can start. And it's like 2 turns later, you're at 15. Like things accelerate really, really fast. It takes a while to get going. But when you hit that point, it's like all of a sudden everyone is right near the finish all at the same time,
mm-hmm.
which is cool. That feels good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a game, the thing that I really like about it is I don't know a winning strategy in it, like when to make a break and start paying for like the higher cost mines to get victory points instead of worrying about the cheap efficient mines that give you better resources but aren't worth any victory points.
Yeah. Well, and my mistake was I got too focused on the patrons, which they, mm-hmm. you know, at the beginning of the game, you lay out all these patrons that each are worth 3, and it's easy to get distracted that there are actually mines out there that are worth 5. So...
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of lose the forest for the trees, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
The other really interesting mechanic that I haven't seen in other games is the idea of reserving a mine. So for your turn, even if you can't afford a mine, you can reserve it and set it aside for yourself. And you actually also get like kind of a wild token that can be used as any kind of gem. So there's some utility outside of just reserving it, but you can use that, offensively to like get something that you're trying to work towards and make sure no one else takes it. You can also use it defensively by looking at someone's board and going, okay, you are clearly trying to save up for whatever. I'm going to reserve it so that you can't have it for plans.
And you see someone with like 7 black gems or something like that going for a mine like that. It's like, oh no, I think I'll take it.
Yep.
Sorry, bud. Yep. Yeah. But you do have a hand size limit where you can only hold 3 of those mines. So you can only do that so often.
You can only hold 3 of them at a time. And also I think there's less like wild tokens than anything else. And so you can still reserve it if there are no wild tokens, but you don't get the added benefit of the wild token. So it's kind of a point of diminishing returns for holding on to too many.
So side question here, is this a board game night that you guys started? This is like what you did after Mansions of Madness, right?
Yes, this was an impromptu. We it was actually after King's Island. We got done with King's Island. The kids needed a nap. And we had said, well, maybe we'll drop off the kids at Oma and Opa's and then go back and ride some of the roller coasters ourselves. But we wound up, we were just feeling wiped and we're like, sounds better to just hang out. And they were like, oh, you know, stay for dinner. And so while we were killing time while the kids were sleeping, we're like, well, we don't have Mansions of Madness because we didn't bring it. Why don't we play Splendor? So the board game, I guess it wasn't a night, the board game afternoon, the board game visits continue.
Mm-hmm. That's good to hear.
Yeah, that sounds very fun.
Yes. So that's Splendor, and that is everything I've been playing this week.
Awesome.
Sweet.
Yeah, I don't think I have any questions about that, so I'll do mine real quick.
Mm-hmm.
So still kind of relegated to this everything is in boxes hell. however, on my iPad, I have been playing Human Resource Machine.
Ooh, I've heard of this. This is like a you're using people to make a computer, essentially, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it is a game by the a studio called the Tomorrow Corporation. The same people who made World of Goo, and the same studio that did Little Inferno. Human Resource Machine kind of has a similar style, a similar tone to both of those games, except it is a little bit of an abstraction for learning how to program in assembly. So you have like one little dude who walks around and you give him very simple commands that add up to like grab a value from your inbox, perform some operation on it, like copying it to a register or copying information from a register or adding and subtracting, very basic stuff like that in order to process the input into the expected output. Think about it like a kind of more palatable Zachtronics game a little bit, like TIS 100 or things like that. This is, you know, more my speed than a Zachtronics game because it is less complicated, a little bit more friendly, and there are fun cartoon graphics, so I get to be distracted.
And you get the thrill of like playing it in fast forward after you've done everything, right? And you it like go off. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's always the best mechanic in games when it shows you like, okay, here's the thing you've been trying for the last half hour for, played out in 5 seconds.
Yeah. Or it's like, oh, if you watch this in real time, it would take forever. However, you have kind of like watched your little dude iterate through every single, you know, instruction and kind of edge case, and you know that like you can just let this go and then just churn through everything. And you know, you're doing increasingly complicated stuff, and also doing things that should be, you know, to my mind, it should be easy, but are actually very difficult. Things like, in order to perform multiplication, basically, you know, there's no operation to do that. You have to figure out how to accomplish that with just addition and the ability to, increment or decrement a variable. Things like that. So I mean, just like people who know about assembly programming or programming at very, very low levels where you are dealing with physical memory addresses and things like that, like this is, you know, Babytown Frolics. However, it is a super neat puzzle game insofar as there is the victory condition and then there are kind of optimizations that you can do either for the number of instructions or for the speed. By which I mean, how many operations do you need to churn through in order to make this thing work? Those are not necessarily, those are sometimes mutually exclusive. A small program might run inefficiently, and a large program might be the more efficient way to go about it. But yeah, just kind of figuring out how to solve the same problem multiple ways and figure out how to simplify your thinking so that you simplify the instruction set and make the, you know, basically make some kind of revelation for yourself about, you know, like, okay, this is a way to accomplish this particular thing, carrying that forward. So it feels very iterative. And that is not just me making a dumb joke about iteration. No, it feels very iterative. It feels like you are building towards something. I am now to the point like where I have stopped dealing primarily with numbers and I'm dealing more with, letters that are kept in the registers and like comparing strings or reversing strings or getting rid of non-vowel characters and things like that. Again, just figuring out how to do that with very simple math is incredibly rewarding. So yeah, Human Resource Machine is a very neat game that is just the right amount of nerdy for me, I think.
I want to throw out that the same company just put out a game called 7 Billion Humans that looks like it's very similar, but it's with like parallel processing.
Yes, that is the reason that I picked this up, because I saw a favorable review of 7 Billion Humans and it is not on portable yet.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But no, like instead of having just one just one worker who is executing those commands. You have many, many people who are getting the instructions and performing the operations at the same time. So I kind of want to play this and be, you know, be done with it by the time I, you know, by the time that comes to portable, so I can be ready for it because it looks really neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's sweet.
Yep. But no, it makes me feel smart. Smarter than I otherwise would, sitting down and dealing with a programming kind of thing, because in the time where I did do programming, I was very, my work, what's the phrase that Merle Mann uses? My work was a monument to efficacious and elegance. So I got the job done, but it was neither pretty nor would it have flied if there was any kind of resource constraint.
Nor would it have flown?
Yeah, flown. There we go. See, I also word good.
So it goes for numbers, then there's letters, and then what's next? Like abstract concepts like love or
I don't know.
So it's a bad sign because Cole, you're the most well spoken of anyone on the podcast.
Yeah. I think I'm just really tired, you guys. Mm-hmm. But yeah, human resource machine, pretty neat. I have no idea how approachable it would be if you are coming at it with absolutely no kind of experience,
interest in programming.
yeah or interest in programming, or if you're coming at it without some kind of background regarding programming logic, like there are tests that you do, like, okay, you know, when you reach this particular instruction, jump up to this previous area or jump past these other ones. There are also, like, okay, if zero, if the value that is that's currently being operated on zero, go here, like, you know, and that's how you set up loops. I have no idea if you came at this from zero, how alienating this would be. If you are like me and you know, just enough, you know, to be dangerous to yourself and everybody around you who might rely on you to do any kind of work like this, then I think that it is just the right speed.
Very cool.
Yeah. And that's everything. So any questions about human resource machine?
I just want to throw out, there's another thing. It's not a game, but it's a thing called NAN to Tetris. That's kind of similar, where it teaches you how to build a computer from logic gates, and it teaches you all the steps in between, mm-hmm. but it's kind of like a similar feeling of like completion, where it's like, okay, I'm just going to learn how to make logic gates from other logic gates. And the next step, okay, I'm going to learn how to do like if then logic or whatever. And like, it similar to what you're talking about, it just makes you feel like smart. It's like, oh, it's great. Gives you a better understanding of how that stuff works underneath the hood.
Yeah. Well, like, so I remember hearing about NAND to Tetris. The idea is that because NAND gates are technically Turing complete, you can use those specifically to not just make a program, but also understand the way processors in general work. So you are starting from this kind of atomic level of just a NAND gate and mm-hmm. building a processor and then building a Tetris program to run on top of it.
Yeah. And so, like, you can do this with other gates too. I don't think it's exclusive to the NAND gate, even though they said this, because I accidentally picked a different logic gate and made all the other gates from that. And it's like, but a similar one where it's like not AND or whatever, or mm-hmm. not NAND, but another one. But yeah, I think they just do that as a way of like, it's kind of like Legos, where you put this together and you say, okay, from this one gate, I can make all the other gates. And then the next step, it's like, okay, so now you have all these gates. Can you make a register out of it? Which is just like holding memory. And like, if you pass it something, it'll rewrite it with whatever you're trying to write to it. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, it just keeps the same value. And like, that's what memory is. And then it'll teach you from there. It's like, okay, so now you know all these little things, make a CPU out of it. And it's like, okay, I got this. And then the second half of it, you actually make a language, like it's their equivalent to like Java or something mm-hmm. like that. And then you write a compiler to it to compile it to machine code, which is kind of like what you did the first half of it. So yeah. I don't know. It's all really cool.
Yeah. I mean, that is an incredibly, I think, canny way to kind of walk somebody through the way the physical arrangement of sand into thought that happens.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Very cool. Yeah. Now I need to bookmark that because it is very intimidating, but also I want to learn more about it. Cool. Well, that is everything. How do you all feel about buttoning it up?
Buttons.
You're getting good at that.
The credit.
Thank you so much, everybody, for listening to this episode of The Level. Really appreciate you doing that. As I've mentioned a couple of times, we are not going to be here next week. However, we'll be back the week after that. So no episode on Friday, the... let me see here. Oh, no, I've lost everything. No episode on the 28th. However, the Yes episode on the 5th of October. So there we go. Also, speaking of October, if you are going to be in the Pacific Northwest, I'm going to be at the Portland Retro Games Expo with Gary and possibly some more people to be at the, you know, to table at the show and also do a live episode. We're going to be actually doing that episode on Super Smash Brothers Melee.
Ooh, fun.
Yeah, kind of with the angle of how do you enjoy Smash Brothers if you are not competitive?
If so, you're casual.
Yes, Smash Brothers for casuals. So I think our table activity is going to be trying to unlock as many trophies as we can over the course of the weekend.
Yeah.
So that's the idea. It's going to be a good time. We'd really love if you would come out. Do not be afraid to approach anybody. You know, we would love to see you there. Cool. Other than that, you know, the usual stuff you can do. Patreon, iTunes ratings and reviews, telling your friends, talking about us on social media, all those good things. Am I forgetting anything?
No, I don't think so. On the 28th, since I will likely still be around and available, why don't we say there'll be some kind of streaming thing that happens?
Yeah.
I'm down with that.
Yeah. So yeah, go ahead and watch go ahead and watch the social media for those.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, I've been Cole Ross at Cole Ross on Twitter.
I've been Dennis Furia at DFuria on GreenLaser73 on Twitch.
You're not on Twitter anymore?
Twitter is officially gone.
Okay.
Aw.
How are you gonna get my once every 2 or 3 year tweets now?
that's what happened, Ben, is yeah. You didn't do it frequently enough, and there's no point in being on if you're not gonna be there.
I'm sorry. I've been Ben Merkel at Merkel B on Twitch.
And stick around for some titles.
I needed a way to stick it to the man, and that seemed apropos at the time.
I understand. I understand the instinct. Cool. So titles. I only have one.
It's more than I have.
Lean Times for Daddy.
Good. I have You Betcha. round of You Betchas. And then shortly after that, Ben coined the phrase "a circle of jerkles," which I don't think will actually be on the episode, but I had to edit.
I think I said a circle of circles, but maybe it sounded like a circle of jerkles.
I heard a circle of jerkles. That tells you where my mind is.
Was that when I took a break to use the restroom and get more water? And yes. Ben posited the very upsetting concept of a circle of water. What else?
Yeah, and then I've got Plot Shortage. Although for some reason that pings in my mind as we've got a similar title at some point. So
Short Sword Shortage.
There we go. And then Everything is in Boxes Hell. Okay. Description of moving situation.
Yes. And is that everything?
That is everything. Give me yours again.
Lean Times for Daddy.
I think it's a nice meta one because I think we only have a few titles.
What's that?
It's like a nice meta title because there's a lean picking of titles that we have for this episode.
Is that your choice, Ben?
That's my choice. I'll throw.
I'm a fan of it as well.
Okay, let's do it.